Welcome to another edition of Old School Guns. This is episode number 62. So we're rolling up. Pretty soon we'll be at 100 in a few months, maybe a year, who knows. But anyway, this is the podcast that tells you like it is. And we have three parts where we talk about politics as they're related to the gun culture. We talk about the gun culture in and of itself. And then we talk about my favorite part, questions and answers. And some of the questions are sent in by listeners, people who listen to this podcast. And some of them are sent in over my email, just in general conversations that I have with people. And then some I actually pick up in person where people, come and ask me at work or wherever that, wherever I've shared that I'm a firearms enthusiast. And if they have a question, they ask it of me. So that's the three parts of this, and we'll go right into, my favorite political story of the week, which is, hey, there's a civil war starting to happen in the Democratic Party. And, everybody could see this coming, and everybody knew it was going to happen. The bottom line is a majority of the Democratic Party is radical socialist. I mean, at least the people in control. Now, you go out and find lifelong Democrats who vote Democrat because their parents did and their grandparents did. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the people who are actually in power and in control of the party. And a lot of them are radical socialists. And they were pretty PO'd last time when Bernie got cheated out of the nomination. They feel that happened. Now, you could do analysis and counter-analysis on if that's actually a true statement. But the fact of the matter is, he did not get a fair shake. And this time around, there are Democrats who are plotting to deny him the nomination. Should he get the majority of delegates, but not the number that he needs to get to cinch the majority or whatever. And that evil, ugly word, superdelegate, has come up again. These people who are delegates, but they vote for who they want, and it's whoever kind of pays them off or who can kind of squeeze them hard enough to make them vote a certain way. Those super delegates, that's just a bad idea, but they seem to be going back to it, just like the rest of their ideas about the country. They like bad ideas. So this is going to turn out to be a mess, but it shows you that the deep division within the Democratic Party, much less the country, and there are a lot of people who are very uncomfortable with socialism. And socialism to you and I means they take guns and they take our property and they give our money and they give our property to people who don't deserve it, who never worked for it. That's what socialism is. And I think another part of the fear of a Bernie Sanders candidacy is they know he isn't going to last. They know this guy's not going to make it. I'm telling you, if this guy even makes it through to November, I'll be surprised. Now, I don't wish him ill, but I'm just saying, looking at him, he's basically an 80-year-old man. He's already had one heart attack on the trail here. The thought of him lasting another 6 months, much less 4 years after that, is just, to me, it's a bridge too far. So I think that's another thing they're afraid of, is they're gonna nominate a guy who isn't gonna be around at the general election. And I mean, that's part of what their fear is. And I think they have the same fear with Biden. He's a crazy old man. I mean, it's a shame. If you've ever seen anybody go through dementia and all the rest of that nonsense, I mean, it is painful to watch. And I think you're starting to see that with Joe Biden. I mean, there's just no question about it. And so they know that those two are there. Then that leaves them with the third grade teacher, Warren, the librarian, Klobuchar, who are both so marginalized, they're not even going to survive Super Tuesday. Neither of them are. And the same thing, I think even Buttigieg, Mr. Booty Cakes, is, he's not going to unite anybody. He's clearly not even anywhere near ready for prime time, not even as a vice presidential pick, this guy. this guy's just gotten a little bit of buzz because he's like the first openly gay, whatever. But Booty Cakes, face it, he doesn't have the experience. And there are a lot of traditionally minded people in every kind of ethnic, racial, or other group that really aren't going to be too enthusiastic about him because of his sexual preference. And that's just the way that is, and I don't think he's going to get very far. So they got big problems on their hands, and the biggest problem is Bloomberg. They know Bloomberg is going to get slaughtered on the gun issue. He's going to get slaughtered. I mean, he cannot. You know, you can't run with saying socialist things, which is a lot of what he says, being virulently anti-gun, and then think that you're going to be the guy who somehow all the downtrodden in the Democratic Party, that their coalition, their identity politic coalition, is going to get behind this weaseled little millionaire. And you know, the other answer too is Bloomberg. I can't remember if he's 77 or 79, but Bloomberg is way up there too. I mean, they do not have, outside of Booty Cakes, a younger candidate who can step up. The candidate that they wanted was Kamala Harris because she's a minority female, young enough, energetic enough, and all that. But she fizzled out because she doesn't stand for anything. And frankly, she's just stupid. You know, as a human being with a certain amount of intelligence, hey, she came out on the short end of the stick. She just is not smart. But they thought that the facade and image of what she was going to bring to the table was going to be enough to eventually carry this all off, and it didn't even get close, not even close. So, you know, this brings us to the thing of, you know, everybody's got to get involved in 2020 because we can't let this election slip away. Can't just sit there and say, well, I think Trump's got it in the bag, therefore I can, you know, worry about barbecuing hamburgers and other stuff. Get out there. The House of Representatives is still in the wrong hands. And actually, I live in one of those flipped swing districts or whatever they want to call that thing. And we got a Democrat in there now, and I'm going to work, even if I have to, you know, knock on doors and convince people that they need to vote against that and vote for someone else. You know, you just have to do that. And all these districts that flipped in 2018, go back out. We need to get most of them back and put the House of Representatives in the right hands. And this also brings me back into, you know, if you don't get involved, you wind up, you know, the two votes I regret the most are for McCain and Romney. I mean, I voted for both of those two idiots for president. And, you know, McCain, okay, he's got the big war record, and he talked the conservative talk and all the rest of it. But the guy didn't really like guns. He didn't like the NRA. I voted for him because I thought he was a better alternative than Hussein Obama, who actually, you know, outside of all his rhetoric, actually didn't really do too much. All he did was kind of make the NFA easier to navigate. So he actually did something that he probably didn't intend. But McCain was a terrible vote. It was not a friend of gun owners, and was going to basically screw over the NRA if he got a chance. The same way he screwed over Trump when he could have been the vote that decided the repeal of Obamacare, and old McCain, you know, couldn't do it. So, and then there's Romney. You know, Romney has proven to be just a liar. A complete cur, you know, just a complete ass. You know, his name is Dipshit Mitt. And, you know, he wasn't going to stick by gun owners either. He would have turned us over at the first opportunity. The moment it was more politically expedient, he would have turned on us. And, you know, that's just the way it goes, those two bad votes. So we just got to make sure that we don't have those kind of choices again. So, got to get behind the man in the White House and also get some of these idiot Democrats out of the frickin' Congress and make them go earn a living in the real world, and then they can kind of basically commiserate with the rest of us. Yeah, and as I'm kind of looking over the political landscape, you know, what are the threats to shooting sports and gun ownership? And, Certainly the thing they're talking about that I've never really heard before, confiscation. They talk about confiscation. They don't really define it to mean all guns or just guns they don't like because they have big magazines or could take a big magazine or because it's an evil-looking black rifle, whatever the deal is. But they are talking about confiscation, and even places like Montana, they got no chance of passing it. But the fact that they're even talking about it and introducing it is a very bad thing, a very, very bad thing. So confiscation is always out there. And then there's kind of the, assault weapon restrictions, which are everything from making certain guns, banning them altogether, or making guns with certain features banned, or the ability to take magazines, or whatever all that nonsense is in California about, you can't have a detachable magazine or whatever else, whatever all that is. So that's the next threat, and that's actually one of the most likely and one of the most dangerous. The next thing is, guns aren't any good without ammunition. So kind of the assault on ammunition, and it's kind of happened a little bit in a couple places where you can't order ammunition online anymore, and they want to register, do a background. Some place wanted to do a background check for ammunition, totally impractical. But the other aspect of this is like the green ammo, saying, well, your ammo is just really dirty, and it's not that we're against it, it's just that we want you to use this green ammo, which is going to cost five times as much and be a way to restrict you from shooting, even though it's been proven. And it's just scientifically, the shooting ranges don't cause lead or bad pollution. Now, indoor ranges can have a problem because of there is some lead particulates that have to be filtered out of the air because it's a closed environment. But outdoor ranges, that's not an issue. And the lead in the ground, the berms that are back there, that's not an issue either. So that doesn't pollute anything. It just sort of sits there. It doesn't create a problem. So that's just the that's just some of the problems that are going there. And we always have that battle. We've actually been doing pretty well, but there's always that battle about ranges and rangeland and can a range be here and do the people who own adjoining land object and all the rest of it. I've been in a couple of those fights with gun clubs. I'm in the gun club and we're fighting for our range, and those go to court. Those get three or four shades ugly. I mean, three or four shades ugly. People who are 10, 15 miles away, I don't want bullets landing in my yard. It's like, well, we're not shooting howitzers, so I don't think that's going to be a problem. It's all the misinformation about firearms comes out in these, if you've ever been to any of these public hearings where, anti-gunners get up. You hear all of this nonsense, stuff that we know completely not to be true, that semi-automatic guns fire like machine guns, on and on and on and on. So, ranges are another area. So, got to be vigilant and just keep on that. And if you don't have a if you don't have any ammo to shoot and you don't have any place to shoot it, gun ownership becomes a lot less fun. So that is that. Well, now we can talk about some gun culture things. And I talked about it last podcast, but one of the things that really gripes me are gun culture bullshitters, these liars who get on there and will tell you anything. And I've got to tell you this is actually kind of a funny story. But one of the forums I'm on, and I don't post there much. I don't do anything. I just kind of look at it. If occasionally it has some useful information. All of them have kind of become this online BS. And you can't believe anything unless you know the poster. You really can't believe what people are saying on there because it's just people typing on a computer. And here is the awesome example of this. This one poster was he claimed to be a World War II veteran. A veteran of the Battle of Britain, an American that participated in the Battle of Britain. He basically after that said he served in the U.S. Army Air Force and in the Korean War in the United States Air Force, and was kind of a had retired and was kind of a civilian contractor advisor thing during the Vietnam War, something like that. Now I can do the math. I can do the math, and I'm like, well, this person would have had to have been, when I first kind of ran across this had to have been a person in their 90s, their mid to high 90s. And so they on the forum they wanted to collect, and they did. They collected a bunch of money and bought a plaque and everything. I did not participate because I don't know this guy. How are you going to verify all this? Well, they had one member who would call him and struck up a friendship, and he basically said, yeah, I kind of vouch for this guy. He's good. He's what he says he is. So we have this Battle of Britain, World War II, Korean War, and on some measure of Vietnam War veteran, telling very interesting stories, ditched a Spitfire in the channel and all the rest of it. Well, it turns out he passes away. And they celebrated his 100th birthday and he passes away. Well, then when they're doing the digging into it, they find out that he was actually born in 1940, had never served in the military. So he was somebody who was in his 70s. He was in his 70s. But he was not in his 90s, and he was not anything that he said, and yet he was lionized. And those are the kind of people you see on these forums. And actually, when you start laughing about that, it's really not funny. But it's actually to think that everybody could have the wool pulled over their eyes like that. There is some humor in that. Other examples are these guys, the CMP 1911s. And I talked about this in an earlier podcast, but the CMP 1911s have brought out some of the very worst in the forum gun culture bullshitters. I kept seeing these pictures of guys saying, yeah, I got this from the CMP, and it would be a original finish, complete Remington Rand, down to the smallest part and all this, and everything else. And there were so many of these posts. I'm like, this. I was really skeptical because I during my service we had 1911s, and I remember when we turned in our 1911s, and this was in 1995. We were probably one of the last units that had 1911s. But just because they adopt the Beretta in 1984 doesn't mean that poof, overnight, every handgun in the inventory is a Beretta. No, they had to make them and accept them and distribute them and all the rest of this. So, the process of getting the Berettas and turning in the 1911s was a lot longer than a lot of people realize through the United States military. So, anyway, just to go there, you see all these beautiful 1911s that are, I got this from the CMP, I got it. And I know what the 1911s we turned in look like. And I know that they weren't, for the most part, and I was a gun guy back then too, so I knew they were rebuilds. And I knew that they had, mixed parts and all the rest of it. Not that that really mattered. It didn't matter to us as users. And it doesn't really matter to me as a person with a CMP 1911. I mean, hey, you're getting a USGI 1911. It's a great deal. So, but you see all these kind of museum quality ones that are posted there. And I suspect that these are guns that are, the original condition kind of guns that have been out there in collector circles for years and years and years. And guys are posting pictures, doing that, saying that they got it from the CMP when in fact they did not. I mean, I've seen CMP 1911s, not just, I've seen them going in and I've seen them coming out. And what a lot of what these posts are not what's coming out. So it's pretty humorous. And you just wonder about people. Why would you do that? Why would you tell a lie? Why would you fake somebody like that? Why would you put people on and accept a plaque and things about being in the Battle of Britain when you were born after it was over, and part of that is the anonymity of the internet, and people who are just, it's almost a version of cosplay with internet identities. People are something other than what they are, and they portray themselves as something other than what they are. So, you get that, and that's just on the informational side and kind of the John Q. Public side. And I've spoken earlier about, the guys that really kind of miff me are these commercial dudes who are kind of cashing in. And shooting has more of these people, well, more of these people than we need, probably. But, a lot of other sports really, really don't have all this. But you get these experts, quote unquote, or these big time competitors, or these guys who are in some sort of a position of influence, they're influencers, and they're telling you all kinds of things. I spoke about the last time, they're influencing you that the 1911 is just a enthusiast pistol, as some sort of backhanded put down, saying, well, if you like it, you're kind of an enthusiast and you're in a general crowd. It's not really good for other things. It's all bunk. It's all bunk. I said it last time. It's all bunk. It's all garbage. The same people who tell you that NIM parts are better than forged hand-fitted parts because they're NIM parts and they're almost all alike. And it goes on and on and on. They tell you this stuff because they want you to buy, and they're using their credibility. I mean, this goes all the way back to one each Jeff Cooper telling you the Bren 10 was the coolest and best handgun that had ever been designed and ever been made. And as it turned out, the Bren 10 was a big, clunky, hard to handle, kind of overly powerful for its use gun. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, and 10 millimeter guns are fine, but they're not general use. No police department. The FBI tried 10 millimeters, and look how that ended up. They got rid of them. All of a sudden, there was the 40 Smith and Wesson as the shootable version of the 10 millimeter. So, you have all that, and so even going back then, they're trying to sell you stuff. They're trying to sell you on all this. They not to bing on Cooper, but we tried to sell you the Scout rifle. It's this great all-around rifle. And the fact of the matter is shooting has evolved to the point where not only do we specially select rifles for a specific purpose, but we also do calibers for that. I mean, you get the 26-inch barrel 6.5 Creedmoor, and both that rifle and the cartridge have been tailored for, kind of that longer range accurate shooting. And if you're going to shoot beyond the range that that combination is capable, you can get 338 Lapua, and there's a whole bunch of other ones now. And there's even a magnetized 6.5 Creedmoor and the 6.5 PRC. So people not only get very specific tailored rifles, but they get very specific tailored cartridges for the use they have. And that's one of the re and optics are the same way. There's hunting optics, and then there are target precision optics, which have a whole bunch of different features that are an advantage in that kind of shooting. So everybody is getting things that are more specific, and this generalist rifle is just not out there. But they will tell you, and every once in a while the company starts to. And I guess the last one was, wasn't it Ruger, who they get Gunsight to, hey, can we put your Raven on it? And they want to sell that to you. But the fact of the matter is they're not being sold because, or at least in the numbers that they would like, because for whatever reason you're buying a gun, you're going to buy a tailored rifle cartridge combo for that. And optics too, not just, the cool looking kind of optics for that. The ones that are mounted forward on the barrel. So we have but the BSers will tell you that everything is super great. They'll just tell you it's great. And I think it's kind of, I understand that they kind of hype stuff, and I understand that there's always the new coolness or the new hotness that they're after, but I just sit there and go, man, when these guys say something, I am so so skeptical about believing it, especially on face value. Especially on face value. So really watch what you see. I think that definitely Brownells will regret this What Would Stoner Do project, the new this they're trying to make it like it's hotness, but I don't think it's really caught on much. I mean, I don't know that there's a lot of excitement. I know, when Brownells introduced their BRN10, the retro AR10, man, that was smoking hot for months. When DSA put out the light-barreled Israeli FAL, that was smoking hot for months. This What Would Stoner Do thing, in spite of all the hype, I don't think there's a whole lot out there. I think everybody's kind of seeing, and I would hope they'd kind of be seeing that when you do the analysis, okay, if you want an AR-15 that's, in an M4 configuration that's, a pound or pound and a half, or maybe even 2 pounds lighter, okay, that's the way to go, but it's going to cost you three or four times as much, and is that really worth it? And I think there's going to be some gamers who will always go for it. There will always be in-range TV fanboys that'll go for it. But I think most people will probably say, yeah, that was very interesting, but no thank you. So we'll see how that happens. But again, I would expect that there'll be another wave of hype with that, and it'll come on their channel. They'll be using it in their matches and talking about how it's greater than everything else that's ever been made, and on and on. So we'll see how that all shakes out. Okay, another thing is, I talked a little bit about progressive loaders on this last podcast, and just to say a little bit more, I didn't really give any background. I started with obviously the single stage press, like everybody does. And that's good for modest or even moderate amounts of ammunition. But when you start getting up, if you want to load 1,000 rounds, if you do it on a single stage press, that's going to be a long time, and a lot of you're going to be pulling on that thing. One side of your body will probably be big and strong, and the other one won't. So pulling that thing down, you're going through five actions to get a loaded round, and that's loaded, that's sizing and priming and belling the case, and then you put the powder in, then you put the bullet in, then you crimp it, and so you're doing all that, and you're doing it a single stroke each time on the machine to do that. And the beauty of a progressive loader is, of course, it can do five things at once. So once you kind of get the first five cartridges in going around, then for every pull down of the lever, you're getting a loaded cartridge, which is pretty cool. Pretty cool. So I started out with, it was called an RCBS piggyback, and it was actually this little contraption that you put on top of the single stage press. And it had its own plates, and it, for what it was, it worked okay. It worked okay for me for a while. It actually kind of the it auto-rotated, auto-indexed, which I didn't like. And it was hard to prime. It just didn't have a lot of power for priming. So those were two things about it I didn't really like. Everything else, it was a super contraption, man. You had it so that you could use your regular RCBS powder measure in it. It was all very cost effective, but it was a super contraption. And I used it for a couple years, and it seemed to work fine. I actually kind of bent the center thing a little bit. I don't know how, but bent that, the auto indexing I never liked, because there's a beauty of a machine that does not auto index, because you can take your time and you can stop it right there in the process and clear things up. It doesn't automatically advance everything. So it's just about paying attention to detail and giving you a chance to look things over. You can check each individual station very easily and all that. So that's why I don't like auto indexing. I used it, the last time I used it, something kind of went awry with it, and somehow my loads, which were just 38 target loads, came out a little more powerful than I wanted. Somehow the charge got that way. And since I was shooting them in a 357 revolver and they were modest loads to begin with, there wasn't a safety issue, but I saw that and said, you know, I really don't like this. And so I really kind of stopped using it, went back to single stage. And then a short time later, I bought a Dillon, you know. And the Dillon is an excellent machine. I really feel comfortable with it. I like it. Once you get everything adjusted, I mean, and it is like the rest, all these machines are fundamentally the same. The levers and springs and this and that, and everything has to be, you probably have to make 50 adjustments to get them up and going if you start from scratch. And you know, and it works out pretty well. Sometimes it won't pick up a primer, sometimes, you know, and then, you know, during the process, you also have to kind of keep it clean, because if you load about 1,000 rounds, there's little, you know, because you pop out primers, there's little shards of primer. There's also, you know, a few powder flakes and you know, all this, they're just the usual dust and stuff around in a loading room. So, you know, you have to keep it clean, because, and you have to keep it lubricated, because there are some of these areas that, you know, go back and forth and need lubrication. You just don't use them dry. So, very, very pleased with Dillon. I don't like converting the calibers. converting, as long as I don't have to switch out the priming, it's okay. But when you have to switch the priming, that's kind of a pain in the butt. Takes you a little while to set all that up. I have never on a Dillon 550 machine have gotten rifle calibers. I'm not really comfortable with that. I still do that single stage. Maybe that's just me, but I've never really gotten the rifle down. And who knows? Maybe that'll be my next thing I try, is to get that. Be nice to load 5.56 on that, because that's something that you go through a lot of 5.56 on ranges, you know, just kind of plinking around and shooting things. So that's kind of what I wanted to say about the mechanical loaders. They're fun. They're good. It's a whole nother hobby, and it will tax if you're like me. I'm not a mechanical engineer, so watching this thing marvelously work and trying to understand the effort that went into design it is pretty daunting. But I do have to say that Dillon makes a fine product, and I'm very happy with mine. And I don't know about others beyond the piggyback, which is fortunately no longer with us on any level. So, you know, but I'm sure the other ones are well done too. But my personal experience with Dillon is they're really first rate. Okay, here's my favorite part of the podcast. That is questions and answers. And our listener, Clown Bear, and I don't think he's a clown or a bear, but he goes by Clown Bear, which is pretty cool, actually. If you've anybody who's ever seen me dancing would probably call me Dancing Bear. So, anyway, from our friend Clown Bear, are there any manufacturers you refuse to buy from due to product issues or politics? Ooh, that is such a good question, because, you know, would I buy something from Colt right now given the issues with the Python? I probably would. I would buy a 1911 from Colt. I'd buy a Gold Cup, or, you know, I'd buy anything. I think the individual product of the Python, I probably would tend to shy away from. And when I got it, I sure would inspect it, because evidently, that's something that they go a little light on before they ship them. I can tell you this. I don't go with any of the inexpensive people, not because I'm better or anything else, but I don't go Jennings, Brico, Jimenez, any of those kind of very inexpensive guns that, you know, are kind of questionable to me. You know, there's some low end stuff I just don't go after, and it's not so much, it's not snobbery, it's just they don't have the quality that I'm looking for. So, you know, kind of excluding all those, you know, there are times when you can get angry with a certain manufacturer. Like, Smith and Wesson has gotten people mad at them over the years. One was when they were owned by a conglomerate that had some anti-gun interests or something. You know, that was kind of one thing. The other thing was the lock that they put on, you know, the safety lock that is now a part of all the new Smith and Wessons. And that's been that way for some years now. So it's not like it's brand new. There are some people who won't buy because of that. I'm not one of those. If the gun is what I want, I'm gonna buy it. Taurus, I told you about the issues I've had with them. I tried to buy a tracker. I went in, I had money in my pocket, was gonna buy a tracker. I looked at it, saw it, liked it, you know, thought it was gonna be good. The two that I examined though didn't work. The ones that were in the display case at the gun shop. So I decided I wouldn't buy that, but I do have a Taurus 22 that I bought for my wife as a birthday present. It's the copy of the little pump action Winchester. That's a great firearm. It really is an outstandingly great firearm. So I've got no problem with Taurus really, and I would buy if I needed it. I think a Judge with the 6.5 barrel would be kind of cool to have. I have no need for it, and I'm not going to get one, but you know, they're modestly priced. I mean, you're going to get what you get. You're going to get a reasonably accurate, reasonably usable gun. So, you know, I would look at that. It's more of, I tell you, the only people that I shy away from, and this sounds terrible, but the only people I shy away from, I really don't care for these Turkish guns that are on the market. And I don't, again, this isn't against, you know, the man in the street in Turkey who's just, he works at the arms factory and is making a living. I don't really like the Turkish government's politics. I don't really like, they're kind of on the shady side of Islamic extremism a little bit. I mean, they were pretty much a secular country. As a matter of fact, I knew some Turks in Bosnia. I never really felt that they were very friendly. They were just sort of tolerant of us, and we were sort of tolerant of them. But in one of the conversations that we had, is one guy piped up and said, "Well, it's in Is Turkey isn't Turkey an Islamic country?" And it was very, very quickly, swiftly corrected by the guy saying, "No, it's a secular country, but the majority of people are Muslims." And so it's gone from that to becoming kind of a Muslim theocracy, more of a Muslim theocracy, and they're kind of on that radical side enough so that I don't really care for them that much. And frankly, most of the guns they make aren't that interesting to me. You know, they make, I think there's ones called Canics, which are kind of copies of the VP9, copies of the kind of German and FN stuff, you know. Not exact copies, but proximate copies. They do make a 1911 A1 clone that looks just like a USGI pistol, basically. And in fact, Military Arms Channel did a write-up, or not a write-up, but a video on those, and said that basically it's a, you know, performs like you would expect a USGI 1911 A1 to do. So that would be pretty interesting, and it's pretty moderately priced. It's like $330, which, you know, in the pistol market today for a brand new gun, that's pretty nice. So do I don't look down upon people who buy them. It's just a personal kind of, it's not even really a choice because I'm not really in the market for any of the guns they really make right now, but they're the ones that appear to be kind of least attractive to me because of where they came from. So if that fits into refuse to buy from due to politics, I guess that's it. I was one of the people, I was, you know, I have this kind of odd view of Ruger. You know, Ruger makes some very cool guns, and I like the Mini 14. I like their single action revolvers. Their double action revolvers are very utilitarian, but they work. They're very, very robust. I've got one of the, I've got the 9mm carbine that I bought years ago. It's one of the first ones, not the latest issue one. And Ruger guns work. They just plain work, but they're not particularly exotic, or they're not particularly high speed looking or anything. I don't want to use the word utilitarian, but they're very it's how we used to view Ford and Chevy back in the 50s. They make these very nice, kind of dependable, not very exciting, but kind of cool cars that are very useful, and you'll get your use out of them and everything else. But they weren't making, they're not Cadillacs, they're not Lincoln Continentals, they're not Imperials. They were, and Ruger kind of makes that gun. When you get a Ruger, you're getting the workman type gun, and I like Rugers. I like them. I just don't think outside of this new 5.7 they've introduced, their guns really aren't that exciting, but they're very, very good. But when Ruger was, during the first assault weapon ban, there was kind of this thing, and you never know how much truth is behind this, where, they said, well, Bill Ruger kind of supports the magazine ban, and he's making plans to feed the Mini 14 like an SKS, and I'm sure they had some sort of plans in case that legislation did happen. Whether or not Ruger actually supported it or that's been misattributed to him, I don't know. But yeah, if a manufacturer turns their back on me and basically says, hey, we're not producing that because, we don't think you should have it, or, we kind of do back this common sense gun control, and find out they got two or three designs already in the works to pick up the slack in the marketplace. Yeah, I probably would be very, very angry and not buy from them due to politics. I'm trying to think of product issues that do that. The only, and I've talked about them, and I don't really buy guns from them, so this is kind of an unfair, but I've never really cared for Sportsman's Guide, and I've told the story when I lived in the People's Republic of California, Sportsman's Guide would not sell me a front sight adjustment tool because, well, that's an AR-15 item. And I'm like, well, so what? AR-15s are banned in California. No, they are not. In point of fact, mine was legally registered, and all the rest of this nonsense that they forced everybody to do. But it was legal to possess, legal to shoot, legal to have. Everything about it was legal. I just needed a front sighted job, just wanted one of those, and they wouldn't send me. And so after some back and forth, I didn't buy from them for years. And I considered that, I would consider that politics. Not so much that their products are bad, but that the politics of what's going on. It's like, look, I understand. You can't sell me a 30 round magazine because now they cannot be brought into California and sold to me new. I understand that. But a front sight tool is a front sight tool, and frankly, that was just ridiculous. So that's kind of my parameters on that. I'm not really angry at anybody at the moment, although I don't think it was very good that Colt stopped making AR-15s for the civilian market. But I completely understand the market is saturated. I mean, there are ARs everywhere, so. I don't really hold that against them. A business decision like that, I don't hold that against them. I shop a lot less at Walmart now. I still occasionally have to go in there and get something, but my Walmart shopping, because of what they did with the pistol ammo, is pistol and intermediate cartridges. Yeah, I probably cut 75% of my Walmart shopping. I'm sure it doesn't mean anything to them because they make, I forget how many ungodly millions of dollars they make, the family makes every hour from Walmart, but the Walton family makes all kinds of money. I think it's every hour they make $1 billion or some nonsensical number like that. And so mine is not even wouldn't even make the chart, obviously, but no, I'll shop elsewhere, and if enough people do that, they'll kind of get the message. They'll kind of get the message. So the next question, oh, and it's almost related. You mentioned the iron sight counter revolution in rifles. Is there a revolver counter revolution as epitomized by the new Python and King Cobra? That's interesting. I like that question. I have to say that I think the revolvers are always going to kind of be there because people like the accuracy that a revolver gives them, especially over some modern pistols that use polymer and are kind of duty oriented and don't deliver precise target accuracy. And you even notice that some of the manufacturers are going back to kind of Walther with their what is it, the Q4 Target 9 millimeters. They did it on built it on polymer, and then they said they came out with it on steel. There's a reason for that. It's I'm sure it's more accurate, but yeah, revolvers are always going to be a basically really good, really accurate, and they're powerful. I will say that a Smith and Wesson 625 in 45 ACP is a very tough, it's very tough to find a gun that will outshoot that, whether it's a custom gun or not. So it's very tough. Right out of the factory, those things will shoot well. And that's the other thing is you can get a lot of, the performance center kind of guns. They can do some really, they make some very cool revolvers. They make some very, very cool revolvers. I think the Python, because of its looks, will ultimately be successful. If they need to jump on this quality thing, they need to jump on the finish, they need to jump on whatever freaking problem is there causing light strikes or whatever else, and they need to put that in the past. They need to fix it, get it in the past, and I think the Python, because of its styling, will always be a very popular gun. I think discontinuing it was stupid. And I think that if they were smart, they'd bring back the Anaconda also. That way they've got the King Cobra, the Python, and the Anaconda, and that would be a very cool trio of guns to have as in your lineup. So I think there is a counter revolution. I think a lot of people like, especially when you get the CCW, there is goodness in the 5 and 6 shot 38 special snub nose revolvers. There's a lot of goodness in all that, and I think it's going to resurface. Yeah, you bet. Okay, what will the future bring for hand loading? I don't know. I just talked about progressive loaders, and that was like the last big evolution. Well, beyond progressive loaders, I would like to see, and this is purely my own selfish interest, I would actually like to see a progressive loader specifically designed to reload rifle cartridges. And I go to the standbys of 308, 30-06, that people shoot a lot of. M1 shooters eat up 30-06, and a lot of other guys shoot 7.62 by 51 NATO, aka 308 Winchester. I'd like to see one specifically set up for that. That would be a very, very useful and economic way to get some rifle ammunition. Rifle ammunition above 5.56 and 7.62 by 39 is very, very expensive, and so there is some opening in the market for, hey, I want to produce at least some ball style ammunition for, the rifles I like to shoot. And yes, there is a cat in the background, and she agrees with what I'm saying, which is what you're hearing. So, anyway, but I'd like to see something. I would be in the market for something specifically designed for rifle with, good, maybe an improved priming system, a bullet feeder, a case feeder, something where I could turn out some ball type ammunition or some match loads that are, similar to that, turn out a reasonable quantity of those kind of quickly. So I'd like to see that. The other things I think we'll see from hand loading are definitely going to be more precision stuff. As precision shooting increases, I think that more precision tools will come out into the market. And you're already starting to see some of that. I think Sinclair International basically does that. And you'll see a lot more tools like that hopefully can handle some more volume. Right now, I think the limitation is It just can't handle it. They produce very, very high quality stuff, but volume is still lacking. So the ability to increase the volume in the same amount of time, I think, is where that's going. And I think there's a market opening for that. Okay. Will 9mm extinct the 380 and 32 ACP? Kind of had a question like this earlier, and my thing's still the same. I think the nine it will definitely make inroads, but I think there's going to be recoil management issues with small 9mm pistols that are not there with 380 and 32. And 380 and 32 in my book perform nearly identically. So the opening in this market is improved ammunition in those two calibers, and maybe and if somebody will put up with the recoil of the 9mm and its improved loads, like I talked about in the last podcast, there's always going to be a market for a lower recoiling cartridge that has some increased effectiveness over its kind of ball ammunition counterparts. So you will see that. I think you will see a lot more small 9mm sold, but I think there's going to be some ammo development for 380 and 32, and it will not become completely extinct due to the number of guns that are out there already and the fact that some people just want to purchase a lower recoiling cartridge. Okay. What is the most fun and impractical gun you own? Well, I can say that there's probably quite a few of them. But rifle, and this is no surprise to anyone who's listened to this podcast, 351 Winchester, most impractical rifle cartridge. It's fun, it's great, but brass is exceptionally hard to find, and a few other issues with it. Semi-automatic, getting it to feed and finding the components are difficult. So there, and I've talked about that ad nauseum in past podcasts, but that's a fun cartridge to shoot. Runner up would be, of course, another one that I've mentioned, 577 450 Martini Henry. And the other runner up in the rifle category would have to be 32 Winchester Special, which is essentially a 30-30, except it's just harder to find brass ammo and bullets for it. So those would be the three for rifle. For pistol, I'd have to say the 50 A&E Desert Eagle is. I'm not a handgun hunter, so having one is strictly just a fun proposition, and it's impractical in many ways. It's big. It's not anything you'd carry for defense. Although if I had it, I mean, I definitely would feel that I could defend myself with it. But it is what it is—a single action, very, very large and heavy, 50 caliber, limited capacity pistol. So it is what it is. But I feel that I could defend myself with it, but it is impractical for all those uses other than handgun hunting or just having fun with. Are there any runner-ups? I would have to say that any revolver chambered in 38 Smith and Wesson is kind of in that same category. They're a lot of fun. But they're impractical just because the ammunition is not as easy to get as 38 Special. It's the 38 stubby little pistol. And in fact, some good news on that is that the Steinel Ammo Company, which also make 32 French Long, which we haven't seen ever, they're making the 38 200. British revolver load. It's got a cast bullet instead of the jacketed bullet, but that doesn't matter because it doesn't operate at a velocity where jacketed or lead matters. But you can actually get most of the stuff you get in the States now has the 146 grain load, and for the Smith & Wesson Victory revolvers and the Webley 38 Webleys. The 200 grain load will probably shoot a little bit better. So that is available, and it's good. And in talking about that, our friend of the podcast very generously let me shoot his French 1935S, which he has procured that Steinle ammo for in 32 French long. And I have to tell you that that thing shoots great. I loved it. He's very generous. That is expensive ammo, and I didn't realize how much it was till I went to their website. But I expended a magazine of it, and I tell you, a very nice shooting pistol. It's got a little bit of pep to it, which I like. It's like a it's not a 32 ACP. It's much more powerful. It'd be like a 32 ACP Magnum. It's a very cool gun. I can understand why that was a very, very popular choice in the mid-1930s. The gun is light. The gun is fairly compact. And it shoots a cartridge that is not a joke, and it shoots quite well. So this Steinle Ammo Company, they're doing a really good job. I mean, I'm going to buy some 7.35 Carcano ammunition for it, because I have a Carcano that is something I inherited years ago. And I want to shoot that in one of our vintage rifle matches, because the ammo for it has been hitherto impossible to find. And when you do, it's either Italian or Finnish surplus, which is very expensive, and you know, you just can't find that anyways. You might find a little supply here and there, but there's no steady supply. So definitely looking forward to getting a couple of boxes of that and shooting it in a match. So getting back to the original point, yes, it is an impractical, I do own some impractical guns. Carcano could be on the list somewhere. You know, but the Carcano is just a pleasant shooting. It's not that it's not fun. It's just a very pleasant shooting rifle. There's nothing really remarkable about it. It doesn't have the kind of the muzzle blast that the 351 has, or the, you know, kind of the, you know, the very unusual cartridge that the Martini Henry has. You know, you look at Carcano ammunition, it looks like normal military ammo. The gun performs like, it's a very nice shooting military carbine. Has same kind of recoil a 6.5 M38 would have, you know. Kind of less, a lot less than 30-06, a lot less than 8mm Mauser, more in the 7mm Mauser, 6.5x55, you know, more in that kind of area. So it's a very, very pleasant rifle to shoot, but it's just rather unremarkable, and it performs rather well. The example I have was one of the Finnish Army ones, where I believe they replaced the front sight and graduated it. It's calibrated for 200 meters. So, you know, and it shoots very well. But there's nothing all that special about it. It's nice, but it's not there. I actually, and it's not an impractical gun on any case, but I really do enjoy the Mauser 1891 Peruvian model. The Argentines kind of reworked them and gave them to their allies, the Peruvians, and it's a very, very cool rifle, as is the 1891 in Argentine configuration. A rifle that was years ahead of its time. And they recognized it and adopted it. But I actually like it, you know, better than some of the later Mausers, to be honest. Especially the 7.65 Argentine cartridge. It performs much like 7.62x51 NATO. It's a very good cartridge, and it has, you know, kind of mild recoil. It's not that 8mm recoil, or that 30-06 recoil that you can get out of Mausers and those calibers. So a very, very useful gun, and very, very well made. They were made by Ludwig Lowe in Berlin, and very, very, which became, later became DWM, which produced all kinds of weapons through a couple of world wars there. But they became a very, very good cartridge, a very, very good rifle with a very, very high quality of manufacture, which is why today you can find them, if you find them in nice shape, they still stand up. I mean, they still shoot, they still do very, very well, 120 years after they were made. Well, that is it for another edition of Old School Guns. You can always leave a comment for us on Podbean, or you can email it to me directly at kbmakel@aol.com. That is kbmakel@aol.com. And we love hearing from you, and we look forward to doing our next podcast. And for now, this is Old School Guns out.